Welcome to Inside Vancouver Opera. My name is Ashley Daniel Foote. As International Women's History Month wraps up, we had the chance to have a conversation with the iconic and incredible Judith Forst, an officer of the Order of Canada and member of the Order of British Columbia, and of course, a Vancouver Opera star from the very beginning. Judy was joined in conversation by up-and-coming young mezzo-soprano and Yolanda M. Ferris Young artist Simran Clare. Now, you're both mezzos, is this true?
Sure, that's the good true. People are.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't you know that? We're much easier to live with.
Oh. Yep.
You've both already sung in some amazing places. Judy, you've sung all over the world, including at the Met. Simran, you sang at Glimmerglass Festival and for former Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. These are some, both of you, heady, heady places to perform. What does it feel like to reach those levels? And how do you feel about continuing to do that?
I don't feel like I've reached the levels that Judy has, not at all. I still feel like a very small fry. But at the same time, Glimmerglass was a huge deal for me when I got accepted there. And the opportunity to study in America, I had never been exposed to these American singers and the American training. It's, I think, just because there's more of it, and it's something about an American mentality. I don't know how to say it. There's more fire in the singers, and so it put a fire under me as well. I think I learned what it meant to be
less Canadian.
Yeah, exactly. Be less polite. Be own myself a little bit more.
Judy, I want to come to you for that because you had discovered this transition too into America. What was that like? What did you discover from that?
When we moved to New York, it was a very different path because I didn't do young artist programs. There weren't really very much of that at that time. I was given this contract at the Met, I think 42 or 48 parts the first year to cover or sing, and from one line to a whole role, like the page in Rigoletto to the Rosina. So it was nonstop learning. Doing one line is worse than doing a whole role because you have to know where to put the one line. And so to learn all the operas, I didn't have time to think about anything except you worked 6 days a week. You had one day off. You were given coaches all the time for everything. So you were just working all the time. Wow. And then studying at night to figure out your parts for 2 months down the road.
It's brutal.
So it was hard, really hard. Yeah. And after, I don't know, 6 years, we moved back here.
But you continued to work incredibly hard, performing everywhere.
Yes, from here. But then by then I was doing my repertoire at that time, which included a lot of pants parts, and then moving to the next stage, which was starting into the bel canto period. And I was fortunate with mentors, Irving Gutman, Lotfi Mansouri, people that saw the next step in me. Don't think I didn't fight them too on it because I was had a good, healthy sense of fear about some of the parts.
What were you afraid of most?
That the parts were maybe not where I should be going. But if enough people, all of a sudden, there were a lot of people asking me to sing Seymour in Bolena. And then something rang a bell and I thought, well, wait a minute, that's odd. So it must be right. But over the years, I had to really know when something wasn't right because my managers, Zemsky Green, would frequently present me with an offer and I'd say, but no. Or I'd be kind of tempted and I'd spend a week at the piano with the part and do what I called the production week. And so I'd sing it every day as if I was in production week and see how shredded my voice was at the end of the week. Or there would be a voice from my kitchen saying, yeah, I think that better go back on the shelf. And that would have been Graham.
Simran, how did you discover your vocal range and how did that journey come about for you? Did you struggle in similar ways that Judy did, or was it a different reality?
Yes, the answer is yes, I definitely struggled. For me, actually, it started because I've always had a higher mezzo voice as well. I sing high notes, but I can't sit up there. When I started studying, I had this notion in my mind that being a soprano meant that you had like a superior instrument. And so I always wanted to be a soprano.
Wild.
I had this like hang up in my mind where I thought that like maybe I had some kind of deficiency in my voice, which is why I wasn't a soprano. And that took a while for me to unwind and unwork and unlearn. I'm definitely very happy to be a mezzo now. I've accepted this and embraced it, I think. I love the repertoire that I sing. But there have been people who question whether I'm singing the right repertoire. I don't think they're correct. I think I know myself and I know that I'm singing what is correct for me. But it's true. It's sometimes people hear like an ease in the top or something and they think that you can just...
Even really important people.
Yeah, exactly.
Richard Bonning, after doing Norma with him, he said, well, you could sing this part. And he said, the other thing he said, I wish we could have done Bohème together. You would have been a beautiful Mimi. I said, Richard, I was a Musetta, and I could never have got through all that passaggio, pianissimo stuff.
Wow. That's choked. The thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I'd have choked. Absolutely. You do know yourself. I was a lyric mezzo. A lyric mezzo usually means pants rolls. Mm-hmm. Certainly for me, it is where I started. I did every, there were pants there, I was wearing them. That's really why I took the first Musetta, was to get out of those wretched pants. But, I mean, some very nice pants, having said that. You know, Octavian is dressed magnificently.
Very true.
And so forth. But usually, you know, it was this Tebaldo, Siebel, Stefano, wonderful moments. And the thing is that you have a wonderful aria, but you don't carry the show. Mm-hmm. So they'll give you those parts as a young singer. And that's why I went into the Met, because I fit the pants.
Love it.
I swear I was in the Met auditions. They took me out of the auditions and said they were going to give me a contract. And then they said, we need you to stay another day to sing to Mr. Bing by yourself in the house. So I stood on the stage, didn't know squat, and sang. And he was all upstairs in the second, third tier up there, walking all around. And then they said, well, we'd like you to be here full year around. They were called plan artists. Mm-hmm. But I knew, I'd heard that when I got there, that they had lost a mezzo. And I could do it because I wasn't carrying a show. But then, I mean, you outlive your usefulness. You age. Mm, mm. And so you don't fit the pants. I mean, you fit them, but, you know, you don't look like a young ingenue.
Judy, I think you still got it.
Yeah, nice. Nice.
Ready.
Nice save. But your voice is starting, you're getting older. It's what is happening with the instrument. They would have kept me there and I would have kept doing the same stuff, not those parts, but maids and whatever was available. Or I left, which is what we did, and I started moving into my repertoire, which the next stage was the Cosis, Rosina. I did the Carabinos, which I hated. I didn't fit. I did them all over, but I was never... My friend, Frederica von Stade, loved doing it because she sat again in a different place. She sat a little bit higher, but she didn't go as high. She mm-hmm. would say to me after, she said, how do you sing all those high notes? I said, well, I don't know how you don't corpse and your larynx isn't at your back teeth doing all those carabinos. And they would always want me to sing quieter. I can't sing quieter. This is as quiet as you're going to get. And so then... What do you do next? Well, that's where Irving and Lotfi came in. And then they said, you know, it's time to try Octavian. It's time to move into the bel canto period. then you try it out. And yeah, my instrument in my 30s would handle that. Then what happens? You get to 40. Okay, you're still singing well. But Rosina, that ship sailed. As a lyric mezzo, then is when you start treading water, trying to figure out where is the next step. I was lucky. My instrument moved into Zalome, the Herodias. It moved into the Janáček, where the theater started to become important. And I was lucky to move into those parts by 50. So I could prolong my career. But it was knowing when to let go of parts.
The canon is what it is. And of course, we're wrestling with the canon. We're using the canon. We understand. But you have always championed new music right from the beginning.
Yeah. Because of my musical strength, the composers at UBC would just always ask me to learn whatever they had written. And I did it. I did all kinds of it. And then one summer, there was Leonard Stern and Kathy Barbarian came to UBC and did a concert, and I got to sing for them. And she, at that time, said if I would come to Italy and live near her or with her,
wow,
and to start doing all like the Schoenberg Hanging Gardens and all this stuff. And he said to me quietly, don't do it. And he said, learn how to sing Mozart before you start doing all contemporary music. Best advice I ever got. Hardest, but because singing Mozart is particularly tricky.
And, just a little, right?
Yeah, just a little. I had to really learn a bel canto technique before I could have success in contemporary music, because I had to understand registers in how my instrument worked, how to sing in a healthy fashion, no matter what they asked me to do, or whether I was standing on my head or whatever.
Right.
And but you, if you don't have a solid technique, you cannot take a flyer, because you have to come back to how healthy are my chords. So I figured that out, and then all the new music that came my way, I was very fortunate to get it. I loved it. I liked working with composers. But it was always tricky, because I always say, if you ask for a change with a composer, you know, it's like asking them to throw out their firstborn child. however, it didn't stop me. And I did many times, even over telephones, I would sing to composers. If you write it this way, this is what you're going to get. If you put it here, then I can give you diction. If
that's amazing.
If you do these alterations, this is then what you'll get. I can offer you four options. But if you write it that way, you get one, and you'll be lucky to get that. Because they frequently would ask, what is your range? And they'd write it all at the bottom of it or all at the top. And you'd have to gently massage it into somewhere that's doable. Yeah, I can go that low. And yes, I can certainly go that high, but not all the time. And so when I had the opportunity for the Vancouver Opera to do Lillian Alling.
Yes, I wanted to talk about this opera.
That was wonderful, because I went to a reading of it. I didn't do the workshop. They had another wonderful singer. And John Astacio had worked a lot with another Canadian singer. We were both mezzos, but this is Beth Turnbull, and her voice sits a third lower than mine. So when I first heard it, I said to John, I love it, but I can't sing it. I'll tell you right now, I can't sing it, because it's sitting just a third too low. And he looks at me. Oh, so then I got the score in Banff one summer I was working there. And Andrea Grant played for me, and we sang the new stuff through. And John Morrell and John Astacio were there. And I said, okay, now I can do something. I know what to do with this now.
Because they put it up a third, right?
Well, everything's moved up.
Oh, how thoughtful.
Yeah. Then I could do it. And then we ended up with a very good piece.
Stunning. One of our favorite productions ever.
And to this day, after all these years, people still talk about that opera to me, that meet me randomly, and how it resonated with them, that they'd all had to deal with an elder going to a care facility and all the things it dealt with. And it was interesting.
There's no doubt that our industry, when you look at conductors, the numbers of female conductors are way too low. There just isn't a number that's good right now. How do you think we can address that in our field? How can we welcome more women to the podium? And how important is that for the kinds of stories and operas that we can then do?
Before we can even have that happen, in Canada, we have to get more work for women to do, or men, because we're in short supply for venues, for things happening in the art form that we do. It seems to be going backwards to me all the time in our country. That's why you're talking about being at Glimmerglass, and I see so many more opportunities in America, because there's so many more, from very tiny companies to mid-size to the big ones. We don't have enough in our country. If they're qualified, they need the opportunity. That's as simple as that. But you have to remember that there's one conductor in every show, only one. Now, in some operas, like something like Cosi, there are six singers. Some, there's 12 singers. But only one conductor, one director. It's a limited job at the best of times. Mm-hmm. But it's the same for our parts as singers. You just have to be as good as you can be and take advantage of every opportunity and look for opportunities. But right now it's hard. There's just not enough.
Yeah, that's right. I know that Tapestry has like a women conductors like incubator program, and I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's providing opportunity, like placement in, mm-hmm. it's providing, yeah, mm-hmm. a new type of role, like an assistant conductor or a repetitor or a place for these aspiring women conductors and emerging women conductors to work. And that's exactly what you're saying, Judy. Like, there is only one role for a conductor in each opera. And how many major opera companies are
Shocking.
There in Canada? You can count them on one hand.
You really can. I'd love if each of you could discuss a time when you had to advocate for yourself or maybe other women in the workplace. And tell me a little bit about that and how you did that. And I'll start with Judith.
I don't remember ever not advocating for whoever I was with. When you're in a cast, I always felt that you were there to work together. This was about an art form that you were trying to do a wonderful performance. It's in our business, for the most part, we got on with it.
Mm.
Because we had to have all the parts covered, you know? And so we did it. I've seen that over all the years I've been doing this. And I just think of a son and a daughter, and they were raised to be human beings. Mm. That was their job. Treat everybody as you want to be treated, and let's get on with what we're doing. And that sounds very simplistic, but if that's the core of and then you build from there, and if there's injustice in a room that I'm in, I deal with it then.
That's great. Yes. I'm struck by what you're saying about this art form being a collaborative one, mm-hmm. and that each cast is a team. It's a unit. We can't exist without the other, and the show cannot go on. It feels often for me kind of isolating or individual, because you spend so much time by yourself in a practice room or working on your own mm-hmm. technique, your own skill set. But it's true, like, when the rubber hits the road, I can't exist without everybody else around me on stage mm-hmm. and in the rehearsal space.
And it's not just the people on stage. It's everybody that is doing what they do
yes.
to make it happen on stage.
Yes.
And that is something that is taught at school at UBC, because every student there has to learn the business. You have to do something backstage. And so by knowing what goes into getting you out there so you can do your work, you're very appreciative. And you honor every talent.
What an opportunity for us to listen in as two incredible mezzo-sopranos compare notes and reflect. Hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did, and thank you all for listening. As always, I'd like to thank our producer, Mac McGilvery,
and associate producer, Tabitha Brasso-Ernst.
I'll see you at the opera.
So we were touring Anna Bolena, and I was doing, I was actually hooking a Christmas tree skirt. And so I'd get up to do my parts, and she'd take over. So I have a Christmas tree skirt somewhere in a box that Joan Sutherland worked on.
Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
That's my claim to fame, and I'm sticking to it.
Oh, come on.